Hey, I'm Dr. Z, and I'm a neurosurgeon. So that means long hours, early rounds, late nights, and everything in between. And through it all, I wear FIGS because they're built for what I do. Through the chaos, through the hours, and through whatever the day throws at me, they do their job so I can do mine. They're comfortable when it counts and functional when I need them the most. So where do you wear your FIGS? On shift, on call, on the couch in the break room, listening to this podcast, wherever it is, they fit right in. And now listeners of this podcast can get 15% off their first order. Just head to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX at checkout. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
My parents and brother refused to take my 12-year-old daughter to the ER after she broke her leg. "We don't have time," they said. Then they made her walk for 3 hours. I didn't shout, I did this. 4 days later, they were screaming in panic. I'm Stephanie, 31, and my daughter Grace is my whole world. She's 12, bright-eyed, and the kindest soul I know. My relationship with my parents Harold and Martha and my brother Jason? That's complicated. When I left Grace with them for a weekend conference, my stomach knotted with worry. I never imagined that 3 days later, I'd be in a hospital room, watching my daughter recover from emergency surgery on a broken leg that my family had forced her to walk on for 3 hours. "We didn't have time for the ER," they said. Before I continue with this story, where are you watching from? Drop a comment below, hit that like button, and subscribe to hear how I handled this unforgivable betrayal. Life as a single mom isn't easy, but Grace and I have found our rhythm. After my divorce from Mark 5 years ago, I've devoted myself to giving Grace stability and love. Mark's job took him across the country, and while he sends child support regularly, his visits are sporadic. Grace understands, she's always been mature for her age, but I've worked double time to fill that gap. To be both mom and dad. My relationship with my own parents has always been strained. Harold and Martha Wilson live in a beautiful lakeside property about 2 hours from our apartment in the city. It's picturesque wooden cabin, private dock, forest trails, the kind of place Grace loves to visit. But beneath that Norman Rockwell exterior lies a colder reality. Growing up, I was never quite enough for them. Harold, a retired surgeon, expected perfection. Martha, a former school principal, scrutinized every decision. Their criticism was relentless. My grades, despite being ace, my appearance, too casual, my career choice, teaching instead of medicine. Even now, at 31, with a master's degree and a stable job as a high school English teacher, I still feel 16 and inadequate around them. Then, there's my brother, Jason. 3 years younger, yet somehow always above reproach. The golden child. The boy wonder who followed our father's footsteps into medicine. Jason could do no wrong, while I seemingly could do no right. When he became an orthopedic surgeon, just like Dad, you'd have thought he'd cured cancer from my parents' reaction. Despite all this, I maintained contact because I believed Grace deserved to know her grandparents and uncle. They adored her in their way. Grace loved fishing with Grandpa Harold, baking with Grandma Martha, and listening to Uncle Jason's hospital stories. I tried to shield her from their subtle criticisms, the same ones that had chipped away at my self-worth for decades. For the most part, I succeeded. So when my principal selected me to represent our school at an educational conference in Chicago, a potential stepping stone to the department head position I'd been working toward, I reluctantly arranged for Grace to stay with my parents for the weekend. "It's only 3 days, Mom," Grace said, packing her favorite books. At 12, she was in that beautiful transition phase, still my little girl but blossoming into her own person. Her dark hair was pulled into a practical ponytail, and her blue eyes sparkled with excitement. "I'll be fine. Plus, Grandpa said we might go hiking to the waterfall." I checked her suitcase, adding an extra sweater. "April in Minnesota can be unpredictable. I know you'll be fine, sweetie. Just remember to take your allergy medication every morning, and don't let Grandpa give you too much sugar before bed." "I know, Mom," she rolled her eyes playfully. "We've done this before, we had, but never for more than a day." Something about this trip felt different. Maybe it was the importance of the conference, or perhaps it was the way Jason had inserted himself into the weekend plans at the last minute. He and his wife Megan were having issues, and he decided to stay at our parents' place to clear his head. Jason's presence always shifted the family dynamic, making Harold and Martha even more dismissive of me. Friday afternoon, I drove Grace to the lake house. The property looked beautiful in early spring, budding trees, glimpses of the lake through the woods, the charming frame house my father had built before I was born. My parents greeted us on the porch, Martha immediately fussing over Grace's light jacket. "That's not nearly warm enough for the forecast," she criticized, ushering Grace inside. "I've laid out some appropriate clothes for the weekend," I'd bit my tongue. Grace shot me a look that said, "It's okay. I'll handle Grandma." Harold barely acknowledged me, focused instead on telling Grace about the hiking trail he'd mapped out for Saturday. "The waterfall is gorgeous this time of year with the snow melt. You'll need proper shoes, not those flimsy sneakers." "I packed her hiking boots, Dad," I said, setting Grace's suitcase in the guest room. "They're the ones you and Mom got her for Christmas." He nodded distractedly. "Jason's bringing steaks for dinner tomorrow, he should be here around noon." Of course, Jason's arrival was the highlight of the weekend. Before leaving, I pulled my mother aside in the kitchen. "Mom, Grace sometimes gets homesick at night. If she needs to call me even late, please let her." Martha waved dismissively. "Stephanie, we've raised children before, successfully, I might add." The implication that I somehow hadn't been raised successfully wasn't lost on me. "Grace will be fine. We don't coddle her like you do." I swallowed my retort. "Also, she's been having some knee pain from soccer. If it flares up, there's ibuprofen in her toiletry bag. Harold was a surgeon for 35 years, and Jason is a doctor. I think we can handle a little knee pain." Her tone was clipped, final. When Jason arrived as I was preparing to leave, he barely spared me a greeting before sweeping Grace into a bear hug. "There's my favorite niece, ready for an adventure weekend with the cool uncle." Grace laughed, and I forced a smile. Jason had always been good with Grace, if somewhat overbearing. His gift-giving was excessive, his stories exaggerated, his entire persona with her performative. But Grace adored him. "Drive safe, Steph," was all he said to me as I hugged Grace goodbye. "Be good, sweetie. Call me tonight before bed, okay?" I whispered to Grace. "I love you more than anything. Love you too, Mom. Don't worry so much. Your conference is going to be amazing." As I drove away, I watched Grace in my rearview mirror, waving enthusiastically from between my stern-faced parents and my smirking brother. That image would haunt me later, my bright, trusting daughter surrounded by the three people who would betray her so profoundly. The Chicago conference started well. My presentation on innovative literacy techniques for diverse learners was scheduled for Saturday afternoon, and Friday's keynote speeches provided valuable networking opportunities. Still, I found myself checking my phone frequently, smiling at Grace's occasional texts about the banana pancakes Grandma made, or the woodpecker she spotted near the dock. Friday evening, I called as promised, but no one answered. I tried three times over 2 hours, growing increasingly concerned. Finally, around 9:30 p.m., my father called back. "Grace is already asleep," he said curtly. "We had a busy day getting the boat ready for summer, and she was exhausted. Could you wake her?" I promised I'd say goodnight. "Stephanie, don't be ridiculous. The child needs rest, not to be disturbed because you're feeling insecure about being away." I swallowed my frustration. "Can you just have her call me first thing tomorrow? We're hiking early. She'll call you when we get back." Before I could protest, he hung up. Typical Harold behavior, deciding what was best for everyone without consultation. I tried texting Grace directly, but the message remained undelivered. I reasoned that the lake house's spotty cell service was to blame and tried to focus on reviewing my presentation notes. What I didn't know then, what Grace would later recount to me through tears in a hospital bed, was what Saturday would bring. According to Grace, the morning began pleasantly enough. Jason arrived before breakfast, bringing donuts and an excessive enthusiasm for the day's hike. My father had mapped an ambitious trail that looped from the property to the waterfall and back, about 7 miles total. Grace was excited but nervous about the distance. "Maybe we should do the shorter trail," she'd suggested timidly over breakfast. "Mom and I usually do the 3-mile one. Your mother coddles you," my father had responded. "You're old enough for a real hike. Besides, Jason wants to see the upper falls." And so it was decided. What Grace wanted or felt comfortable with was irrelevant. What Jason wanted was the priority. A family dynamic I knew all too well. They set out around 9 a.m. Grace wore the proper hiking boots I'd packed, along with jeans and layers as the spring day promised to warm up. Her backpack contained water, trail mix, and her phone, which my mother promptly confiscated. "No electronics in nature," Martha declared. "This is family time." The first half of the hike went smoothly. They reached the waterfall by noon, where they ate the sandwiches Martha had packed. Grace described how beautiful the falls were, swollen with spring runoff, cascading dramatically over moss-covered rocks. It was on their return journey, about a mile from the waterfall, that everything went wrong. The path narrowed as it followed a stream, becoming rocky and slick with spray from the rushing water. Grace was careful, but my father and Jason set a brisk pace ahead, with Martha following close behind them. No one was watching when Grace's foot slipped on a moss-covered rock. Her leg twisted awkwardly as she fell, and she heard a sickening crack. The pain was immediate and overwhelming. Grace screamed, a sound that echoed through the forest. My family rushed back to find her crumpled on the trail, clutching her right leg, tears streaming down her face. "It's broken," she gasped. "Something snapped. I heard it." Jason knelt beside her, his medical training finally useful. He examined her leg, which was already beginning to swell. "Looks like a tibia fracture," he concluded. "We need to get her to an ER." Grace felt a momentary relief. Uncle Jason was a doctor. He would help her. They would call her Mommy and everything would be okay. But then my father checked his watch. "We have dinner with the Hendersons at 7, he reminded Martha. "We'd never make it to the hospital and back in time." "Can't we cancel?" Grace asked through her tears. "It really hurts." Martha's lips thinned. "The Hendersons are your grandfather's oldest friends. We've had this dinner planned for months." Grace looked to Jason, hoping her uncle the doctor would insist on proper medical care. Instead, he shrugged. "It's probably just a hairline fracture, not a big deal. We can ice it at the house and reassess. But how will I get back?" Grace.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Hey, I'm Dr. Z, and I'm a neurosurgeon. So that means long hours, early rounds, late nights, and everything in between. And through it all, I wear Figs. Because they're built for what I do. Through the chaos, through the hours, and through whatever the day throws at me, they do their job so I can do mine. They're comfortable when it counts and functional when I need them the most. So where do you wear your Figs? On shift, on call, on the couch in the break room listening to this podcast? Wherever it is, they fit right in. And now listeners of this podcast can get 15% off their first order. Just head to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX at checkout. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
Grace asked, the pain making her dizzy. "I can't walk on this. The solution my family devised still makes my blood boil when I think about it." My father fashioned a makeshift walking stick from a branch. Jason declared that walking it off might actually be good. Weight-bearing fractures heal better, he claimed. A dangerously oversimplified medical assertion. And Martha simply stated that they didn't have time for dramatics. No one carried her, no one went for help. Instead, they forced my 12-year-old daughter to walk 3 hours back to the house on a broken leg. Grace described the journey as a blur of pain. Every step was agony. She cried until she had no tears left, then continued in silent suffering. She begged for her phone to call me. They refused. She asked to rest. They allowed only brief stops, hurrying her along with reminders of the precious dinner engagement. By the time they reached the house, Grace's leg was grotesquely swollen, her skin mottled with bruising from knee to ankle. She couldn't put any weight on it at all anymore, so Jason and my father half-carried her the final quarter mile. At the house, their treatment consisted of ice, ibuprofen, and elevating her leg on pillows in the guest room. Martha brought her soup and crackers, then left her alone while they all showered and dressed for dinner. "We'll only be gone a few hours," my mother told her. "There's water by your bed and the TV remote. Try to rest." Grace, in excruciating pain and abandonment, watched through the window as all three of them drove away to dinner, leaving her completely alone with a broken leg in a house 2 miles from the nearest neighbor. She tried using the landline to call me, only to discover it was dead. A tree had fallen on the line earlier that week, a detail my family had conveniently forgotten to mention. With no cell phone and no way to call for help, Grace lay in bed, alternating between tearful agony and stretches of exhausted unconsciousness. Meanwhile, I was texting and calling from Chicago, growing increasingly frantic as Saturday evening stretched into night with no word from my family or daughter. By Sunday morning, I was beside myself with worry. No calls, no texts, nothing since Friday afternoon. I'd left dozens of messages for my parents, Jason, even trying their neighbors. The final session of my conference wasn't until 2 p.m., but by 9 a.m., I'd made my decision. I informed the organizers of a family emergency, packed my bags, and hit the road for the 3-hour drive back to Minnesota. The entire drive, my mind cycled through scenarios ranging from mundane dead batteries, poor reception, to catastrophic. By the time I turned onto the gravel road leading to my parents' property, my hands were shaking on the steering wheel. The first thing I noticed was that all three cars were there, my father's SUV, my mother's sedan, and Jason's ostentatious sports car. At least they were home. I pulled up to the house around noon, the gravel crunching beneath my tires. No one came out to greet me. I walked in without knocking. It was still my childhood home after all. The scene in the living room was surreally normal. My parents and Jason were playing Scrabble at the coffee table, coffee mugs and Sunday pastries arranged neatly nearby. All three looked up in surprise. Stephanie? We weren't expecting you until tonight, my mother said, her tone suggesting I'd committed some social faux pas by arriving early. I've been trying to reach you for nearly 2 days, I said, struggling to keep my voice level. Where's Grace? Still sleeping, Jason replied casually. She's fine. Just taking it easy after a little tumble on the trail yesterday. The dismissive way he said it, a little tumble sent alarm bells ringing. What tumble? What happened? My father sighed, setting down his gravel tiles. She slipped on some rocks and hurt her leg. Nothing serious. We've been keeping an eye on it. If it's nothing serious, why didn't anyone call me? Why hasn't she called me? The landline's down, my mother offered. And you know cell service is spotty up here. Where's her phone? I demanded. I have it, my mother admitted. She was getting too dependent on it. We wanted her to enjoy the weekend without technology. I didn't wait to hear more. I strode toward the guest bedroom, my parents and Jason trailing behind, still offering excuses and assurances that I was overreacting. The sight of Grace stopped me cold in the doorway. My daughter lay on the bed, her face pale and drawn with pain. Her right leg, propped on pillows, was swollen to nearly twice its normal size, with bruising so dark it looked almost black in places. Her eyes, rimmed red from crying, widened when she saw me. Mom, she whispered, fresh tears spilling, you came early. I was at her side in an instant. What happened, sweetheart? What did they do to you? Through broken sobs, Grace told me about the fall, the crack she'd heard, and the agonizing 3-hour walk back to the house. How they'd left her alone to attend their dinner, how no one believed how bad it was, how much it hurt all night long. As she spoke, I gently examined her leg, my horror mounting. The misalignment was visible even to my untrained eye. This wasn't a sprain or a minor fracture, this was serious. I turned to face my family, who stood clustered in the doorway. You made her walk on this? For 3 hours? And then you left her alone. We gave her pain medication, my mother defended weakly. 2 ibuprofen, Grace corrected in a small voice. Jason said it was just a hairline fracture, my father added, gesturing to my brother as if his medical degree made this neglect acceptable. Jason shrugged. It looked minor yesterday. Besides, kids are resilient. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. She needs a hospital. Now don't be dramatic, Stephanie, my father said. If you'd let me look at it. No. I cut him off, my voice deadly calm. You've done enough. I'm taking my daughter to the emergency room. I gathered Grace in my arms, ignoring my family's continued protests. She was lighter than I expected, or perhaps adrenaline made her weight insignificant. I carried her to my car, my parents and Jason following with a bizarre mixture of defensive excuses and suddenly helpful suggestions. Should we come with you? My mother asked as I carefully settled Grace in the back seat, arranging pillows to elevate her leg. No, I answered without looking at her. You've done enough. The 20-minute drive to the nearest hospital was tense with Grace's whimpers each time the car hit a bump. I called ahead so they'd be ready for us. By the time we arrived, Grace's pain had escalated to the point where she could barely speak. The emergency room staff took one look at her leg and rushed us into a treatment room. The doctor, a kind-faced woman named Dr. Rivera, ordered immediate x-rays and pain medication. When she returned with the results, her expression was grave. Grace has a displaced tibial shaft fracture, she explained, showing me the x-rays. See this angle here? The bone has completely broken and shifted. What concerns me most is the delay in treatment. Walking on this injury has caused soft tissue damage and increased the risk of complications. What kind of complications? I asked, my throat tight. Compartment syndrome is our immediate concern. That's increased pressure within the muscle compartment that can damage nerves and blood vessels. There's also risk of infection, improper healing, and long-term mobility issues. What does she need? Surgery, Dr. Rivera said firmly. We need to realign the bone and stabilize it with screws and a plate. Our orthopedic surgeon is being called in. He'll be here within the hour. I nodded, trying to process everything. And if this had been treated immediately after the injury? Dr. Rivera's expression told me everything. A clean break might have needed just a cast. Walking on it changed everything. As Grace was prepared for surgery, I sat beside her bed, holding her hand. The weight of what my family had done, the unnecessary pain they'd caused, the complications they'd created, settled over me like a suffocating blanket. I trusted them with my most precious person, and they had utterly failed us both. When my parents and Jason appeared in the doorway of the treatment room an hour later, I felt nothing but cold, crystalline rage. The pediatric orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Layton, arrived promptly. After examining Grace and reviewing her x-rays, he confirmed what Dr. Rivera had told us. Grace would need emergency surgery to repair the displaced fracture and address the soft tissue damage caused by walking on the broken bone. We'll need to place a titanium rod and several screws, he explained. In a child her age, we'd typically try to avoid such invasive measures, but the displacement is severe, and there's significant soft tissue involvement. Grace squeezed my hand, her eyes wide with fear. Will it hurt? Dr. Layton's expression softened. You'll be asleep for the surgery, and we'll manage your pain carefully afterward. The good news is that young bones heal remarkably well. With proper care and physical therapy, you should regain full function. As they prepared to take Grace to surgery, I kissed her forehead, promising to be there when she woke up. The moment they wheeled her away, I turned to face my family, who had been hovering awkwardly by the door. Stephanie, don't you think you're overreacting? My father began. Surgery seems extreme. If they'd just let me examine her properly, stop, I said, my voice low and controlled. Just stop. We didn't know it was this serious, my mother interjected. Grace didn't indicate it was this bad. She was crying in pain for hours, I countered. She heard the bone break. She told you it was broken. Kids exaggerate, Jason said with a dismissive wave. I see it all the time in my practice. They come in thinking they're dying when it's just a sprained ankle. Something in me snapped. This isn't just anything, Jason. This is a displaced tibial fracture with soft tissue damage. You're an orthopedic surgeon. You should have recognized the severity immediately. In a proper examination setting, maybe, he defended, out on a trail with limited visibility. Then you should have erred on the side of caution. I was shouting now, drawing concerned looks from the nursing staff. I lowered my voice. You should have carried her out. Called for help, done literally anything other than force her to walk for 3 hours on a broken leg. We had dinner plans, my mother said weakly. I stared at her, incredulous. Dinner plans. You left my injured minor child alone in an empty house with no working phone because of dinner plans. The Hendersons are very important to your father, she explained, as if this clarified everything. More important than Grace's health, than her safety? Now, Stephanie, my father interjected, using the condescending tone that had silenced me throughout my childhood. You're being emotional. These doctors are probably overreacting to cover themselves legally. I've seen it countless times. I closed my eyes, memories flooding back. My sprained wrist at 10 that my father declared just bruised until the school nurse sent me for x-rays 3 days later. The time Jason broke our neighbor's window, but I was punished because Jason wouldn't do that. The consistent, persistent pattern of minimizing my concerns while elevating Jason's opinions. Grace could have permanent damage, I said quietly. She's 12 years old and may need physical therapy for months because you couldn't miss a dinner party. Because you couldn't admit that maybe, just maybe, her pain was real and significant. She'll be fine, Jason insisted. Kids bounce back. Remember when I broke my arm climbing that oak tree? Dad said it right there in the kitchen. And you received proper follow-up care the next day, I reminded him. You weren't forced to climb back down the tree on your broken arm. The waiting room fell silent. A nurse approached cautiously. Miss Mitchell? Your daughter's in surgery now. It should take about 2 hours. There's a private waiting area for families if you'd prefer. I nodded gratefully. Thank you. As I gathered my purse to follow her, my mother stepped forward. We'll wait with you. I stopped, turning to face all three of them. In that moment, with Grace in surgery, I saw my family with complete clarity, perhaps for the first time. These people, bound to me by blood, had repeatedly shown me who they were. I just hadn't been willing to believe it until they endangered my daughter. No, I said calmly. You won't, Stephanie, be reasonable, my father started. Reasonable? I laughed, a hollow sound. Was it reasonable to make Grace walk 3 miles on a broken leg? Was it reasonable to leave her alone, in pain, without a working phone? Was it reasonable to prioritize a social engagement over a child's health and safety? We made a judgment call, Jason defended. It's easy to criticize in hindsight. A judgment call, I repeated. Well, I'm making one now. I want you to leave. My mother's face crumpled. But Grace will have me here when she wakes up. She doesn't need to see the people who ignored her pain and caused her additional suffering. You're being dramatic, my father said dismissively. As usual. Maybe I am, I conceded. But I'm also her mother. And right now, that means I need to protect her. Even from family. Especially from family. Jason stepped forward, his expression hardening. You know, this attitude is exactly why Mark left. You always blow everything out of proportion. The low blow was meant to hurt me, to make me back down as I had so many times before. Instead, I felt an odd sense of calm. Grace is having emergency surgery because you, a trained orthopedic surgeon, decided a dinner party was more important than properly treating her broken leg. That's not blowing things out of proportion, that's stating facts. I met his gaze steadily. Now please leave, all of you. My father's face reddened with anger. If we leave now, don't expect us to come back. It was meant as a threat, but it felt like freedom. I don't. As they stormed out, muttering about ingratitude and overreaction, I felt no satisfaction, only a bone-deep weariness and concern for Grace. The surgery lasted nearly 3 hours, longer than expected due to the complexity of the repair. When Dr. Layton finally came to update me, his expression was cautiously optimistic. "We've stabilized the fracture with a titanium rod and screws," he explained. "There was significant soft tissue damage that needed attention, but we're confident we've addressed all the issues. She's in recovery now and doing well." "Long-term prognosis?" I asked. "With proper follow-up care and physical therapy, she should regain full function. She'll need to be non-weight-bearing for at least 6 weeks, followed by a graduated return to activities. The hardware may need to be removed in a year or so once healing is complete." I nodded, relief washing over me. "Can I see her?" Grace was groggy from anesthesia when I entered the recovery room, her right leg immobilized in a temporary splint until the swelling subsided enough for casting. Her face brightened slightly when she saw me. "Mom," she whispered, "you're still here." I took her hand, careful of the fore line. "Of course I am, sweetheart. I'm not going anywhere." She glanced around the room. "Where's Grandma and Grandpa, and Uncle Jason?" I hesitated, uncertain how much to share in her fragile state. "They had to go, honey. But don't worry about that now. You just focus on resting." Grace's eyes filled with tears. "They didn't believe me, Mom. I told them how bad it hurt, but they said I was being dramatic. Uncle Jason said I was fine." I swallowed hard against my own tears. "I believe you, Grace. I always will. And I'm so sorry this happened." As she drifted back to sleep, still holding my hand, I made a silent promise to both of us. This would never happen again. No matter what it took, I would protect her, even if that meant cutting ties with the family who had betrayed us both so profoundly. The days following Grace's surgery were a blur of hospital rooms, medication schedules, and logistical challenges. Grace remained hospitalized for 3 days, her leg now encased in a temporary splint while the swelling subsided. I slept in the uncomfortable recliner beside her bed, especially once I explained the circumstances. Grace's teachers arranged to send assignments so she wouldn't fall behind. Our community, the real one, made of friends and colleagues rather than blood relations, rallied around us. My parents and Jason made no attempt to visit during Grace's hospital stay. Instead, they launched a campaign of texts and voicemails that cycled between defensive justification and accusatory deflection. My mother claimed they were giving us space. My father insisted the doctors had overreacted with unnecessary surgery. Jason suggested that Grace's recovery would have been simpler if you hadn't rushed her to the ER and let me handle it. I read these messages with a strange detachment, as if they were artifacts from a past life. Each one only confirmed that I'd made the right decision in asking them to leave. The only family member who reached out with genuine concern was my Aunt Eleanor, my father's sister. She and my father had been estranged for years, a situation I now understood with crystal clarity. When she called after somehow hearing about Grace's injury, her first words were, "What can I do to help?" Eleanor lived 3 hours away, but offered to drive up the following weekend. "I'm not surprised Harold and Martha handled this poorly," she said bluntly. "They did the same thing when you broke your collarbone at soccer camp. Told you to tough it out for 2 days before your coach insisted on an x-ray." I had almost forgotten that incident, buried beneath years of similar dismissals. "I thought that was normal," I admitted, "that all families worked that way." "It's not normal," Eleanor assured me. "It's neglect, plain and simple." When we finally brought Grace home from the hospital, our apartment presented new challenges. The third floor walk-up that had never bothered us before now seemed like an insurmountable obstacle. Grace couldn't put any weight on her right leg for at least 6 weeks, meaning she needed crutches to navigate even the simplest tasks. That first night home, I helped her bathe, change, and settle into bed, both of us exhausted from the ordeal. As I tucked her in, Grace asked the question I'd been dreading. "Are we ever going to see Grandma and Grandpa again, or Uncle Jason?" I sat on the edge of her bed, choosing my words carefully. "I don't know, sweetheart, what they did, making you walk on your broken leg, leaving you alone when you were hurt. That wasn't okay, it wasn't safe." Grace nodded solemnly. "I kept thinking you would have believed me, you would have taken me to the doctor right away." "Always," I promised her. "I will always believe you when you're hurt, and I will always make sure you get the care you need." "Grandpa said I was being dramatic. Like you." Her voice was small, uncertain. "Is that bad, being like you?" My heart broke a little at her words. "Grace, listen to me. You were not being dramatic. Your leg was broken, badly broken. The doctors confirmed that. And being like me?" That's the greatest compliment I could ever receive, because you are kind and brave and honest, all the things I aspire to be. She seemed to accept this, but I could see the hurt lingering in her eyes, not just physical pain, but the deeper wound of betrayal by people she'd trusted and loved. The practical aspects of Grace's recovery proved challenging. Our health insurance covered much of the surgery and hospital stay, but the deductible, CO pays, and upcoming physical therapy sessions would strain our budget. I applied for a medical leave from work, but it would only cover a portion of my salary. My friend Melissa, a fellow English teacher, organized a meal train. Another colleague, Tom, lived in our building and offered to help carry Grace up and down the stairs when necessary. My ex-husband Mark called from Seattle, horrified by what had happened, and arranged to have groceries delivered weekly. The most difficult conversation was with Mark about my parents' role in Grace's injury. He had always liked them, finding my complaints about their behavior exaggerated. Now, hearing what they'd done, he was stunned into silence. "Jesus, Steph," he finally said. "I thought you were just being sensitive all those years. I had no idea they were capable of something like this."
"Neither did I," I admitted. "Not to this extent. Do you want me to fly out? I can take some time off."
The offer surprised me. Mark hadn't taken time off for Grace since our divorce.
"No. But thank you for offering, we're managing. But maybe you could FaceTime her more regularly? She could use the extra support right now, of course, anything she needs." He paused.
"And what about your parents? What are you going to do about them?" It was the question I'd been wrestling with since the hospital. What do you do when the people who should love and protect you the most demonstrate such callous disregard? How do you reconcile the bonds of family with the need to protect yourself and your child?
"I don't know yet," I told him honestly. "But I know I can't let them hurt her again." After we hung up, I sat at the kitchen table with my laptop, researching medical neglect by grandparents, and cutting ties with toxic family. The search results were overwhelming, but a link to a support group for adults estranged from parents caught my attention. I joined immediately. That night, I consulted with a family law attorney, Patricia Reyes, who specialized in child protection cases. I explained the situation, showing her Grace's medical records and the text messages from my family afterward. "What they did constitutes medical neglect," Patricia confirmed. "As Grace's mother, you have every right to restrict their access to her. If you want to pursue legal action, we could potentially file for a restraining order, based on the harm they caused."
"I don't think it will come to that," I said. "They're more likely to disown me than try to force contact, but I want to understand my options."
She nodded. "Document everything. Save those texts. Keep records of Grace's medical treatment and recovery. If they do attempt to force contact or undermine your parental authority, you'll be prepared." As Grace began her long recovery process, the magnitude of what had happened continued to unfold. Simple tasks like showering or getting to school became logistical operations. Grace, with the resilience of youth, adapted to crutches and developed impressive upper body strength. But the psychological impact was harder to measure. She began having nightmares about falling and being abandoned in the woods. She grew anxious when I was out of sight for too long. When my mother sent her a cheerful get well soon card with no acknowledgement of what they'd done, Grace stared at it for a long time before quietly asking me to throw it away.
"They don't think they did anything wrong, do they?" she asked.
"No, sweetheart, they don't. Some people find it very hard to admit when they've made mistakes." She considered this. "I don't want to be like that. I want to be able to say I'm sorry when I mess up." In that moment, I recognized that despite the trauma and pain, Grace was learning valuable lessons about accountability, empathy, and self-worth, lessons my parents had never managed to grasp. As the days passed, my parents' and Jason's messages grew increasingly hostile. They accused me of turning Grace against them, of overreacting to a minor incident, of being an ungrateful daughter after all they'd done for me. Not once did any of them acknowledge the severity of Grace's injury or express genuine remorse for their role in it. For days after bringing Grace home from the hospital, I made my decision. It wasn't impulsive or emotional, but the measured conclusion of a lifetime of evidence. My family had shown me, repeatedly, who they were. It was time I believed them. For days after bringing Grace home from the hospital, I sat at our kitchen table with a legal pad, Grace's medical records, and a sense of calm determination. My daughter was napping in her room, the morning's physical therapy session having exhausted her. Her temporary splint had been replaced with a full cast, bright blue at her request, already accumulating signatures from the few visitors we'd welcomed. I began drafting a letter. Not an angry tirade or emotional plea, but a clear, factual account of what had happened and what would happen next. I included copies of Grace's x-rays and the surgical report, with key phrases highlighted: displaced tibial fracture, soft tissue damage due to walking on the injury, delayed medical treatment complicating recovery. To my parents I wrote, Harold and Martha.
I'm providing Grace's medical record so you can fully understand the severity of her injury and the consequences of your decisions last weekend. As her mother, I trusted you to keep her safe. That trust has been irreparably broken. Grace will require extensive physical therapy and may need additional surgery to remove the hardware. She will miss the remainder of her soccer season and possibly the start of next year's. At 12 years old, she has experienced unnecessary pain and trauma that could have been avoided with basic compassion and appropriate medical attention. After considerable reflection, I've decided to terminate our relationship. This isn't a temporary cooling-off period or an emotional reaction. It's a necessary step to protect Grace from further harm. Do not contact Grace directly through any means asterisk. Do not contact me except through the legal representative copied on this letter asterisk. Do not visit our home or Grace's school asterisk. Do not attempt to use other family members as intermediaries. If you violate these boundaries, I will pursue legal protection without hesitation. I don't make this decision lightly. It comes after a lifetime of dismissal, favoritism, and emotional manipulation that I allowed to continue because I believed family connections were inherently valuable. Grace's broken leg has broken that illusion as well. Stephanie. To Jason, I wrote a similar letter, adding, as a medical professional, your failure to properly assess and advocate for Grace's injury is particularly inexcusable. You prioritize dinner plans over a child's broken leg. Your medical license may permit you to practice, but your judgment that day revealed a fundamental lack of compassion and professional ethics that no credential can disguise. Asterisk. I sent the letters by certified mail, ensuring delivery confirmation. Copies went to my lawyer, Patricia, who had helped me draft the legal language. I also changed both our phone numbers and email addresses, creating new ones that only trusted friends and colleagues would receive. Grace watched me place the letters in the mailbox outside our apartment building, her expression solemn beyond her years. Is this forever? She asked as we made our slow way back up the stairs, she on crutches, me carrying her backpack. I don't know, I answered honestly. Right now, we need space to heal you physically, both of us emotionally. Someday, if they can truly understand what they did and take responsibility, maybe things could be different. But that would require them to change in ways they've never shown that the capacity for, she nodded thoughtfully. I'm sad but also relieved. Is that weird? Not at all, it's exactly how I feel too. The responses came quickly and predictably. My father's lawyer contacted Patricia with veiled threats about my mental stability and parental alienation. My mother sent a tearful voicemail to my school office, the only number she still had, begging to speak to Grace, just for a minute. Jason sent a scathing email to my new address. How he found it, I'll never know, accusing me of professional slander and threatening legal action of his own. None of them acknowledged the harm they'd caused. Patricia handled the legal threats efficiently, responding with copies of Grace's medical records and statements from her doctors about the impact of delayed treatment. The threats quieted after that, though the emotional manipulation attempts continued sporadically. Meanwhile, Grace's recovery progressed slowly but steadily. 6 weeks of non-weight-bearing turned into partial weight-bearing with a walking boot. Physical therapy 3 times a week helped her regain strength and mobility. Her therapist, Diane, incorporated psychological support as well, helping Grace process the betrayal she'd experienced alongside the physical trauma. My aunt Eleanor became a regular presence in our lives, driving up every other weekend to help with groceries, laundry, or simply to provide adult company for me. Through her, I learned family history I'd never known, patterns of neglect and favoritism that stretched back generations. Your grandfather did the same to your father, she told me one evening as we shared tea after Grace had gone to bed. Minimized his pain, taught him to suppress emotions, favored the son who most mimicked his stoicism. Harold became what he was raised to be. That explains it, I said. But it doesn't excuse it. No, she agreed. Understanding the origin of behavior doesn't obligate you to accept its continuation. As the weeks passed, we established new routines and traditions. Sunday mornings became pancake breakfasts with whatever toppings we craved. Friday nights were movie nights with takeout from local restaurants we'd never tried before. We started a 2-person book club, reading the same novels and discussing them over hot chocolate. In place of the family we'd lost, we strengthened connections with the people who showed up for us consistently. My colleagues who covered classes when Grace had appointments, neighbors who helped with stairs and errands, even Mark, who surprised us both by flying in for a long weekend to see Grace and help with household projects I'd been postponing. 3 months after surgery, Grace returned to school full-time. Her mobility was still limited, but the walking boot allowed her independence. Her friends had been supportive throughout, visiting with homework and gossip, making her feel included despite her absence. Her teachers accommodated her needs without making her feel singled out. The support group for adults estranged from parents became an invaluable resource. Through their stories, I recognized patterns in my own upbringing that I'd normalized. The constant criticism disguised as concern, the dismissal of my feelings, the golden child scapegoat dynamic between Jason and me. I began to understand that cutting ties wasn't an act of vengeance, but of self-preservation. 6 months after the incident, Grace had her hardware removal surgery, a less invasive procedure with a quicker recovery time. By then, we had received no direct contact from my parents or Jason for nearly 3 months, though I occasionally heard through mutual acquaintances that they were telling a very different version of events, casting themselves as victims of my unstable behavior and overprotectiveness. I found I no longer cared what they said. The truth was in Grace's medical records, in the scar on her leg, in the therapy sessions she still attended. The truth was in our daily lives, which had grown more peaceful and authentic without the constant undercurrent of criticism and judgment. On the day Grace was cleared to return to all normal activities, including soccer practice, we celebrated with a special dinner at her favorite restaurant. As we shared a dessert, she looked up at me with an expression of quiet contemplation. "Mom, I've been thinking about Grandma and Grandpa and Uncle Jason." My heart skipped. "What about them, sweetie? I don't miss them as much as I thought I would." She traced patterns in the chocolate sauce with her spoon. "Is that terrible to say?" "Not at all," I assured her. "Relationships should add value to your life, not drain it. Even family relationships." "I miss the idea of them," she continued. "Like, having grandparents who come to school concerts, and an uncle who teaches me cool stuff. But the real them, they made me feel small. Like my feelings didn't matter." "They made me feel that way too," I admitted, "for most of my life." She nodded, understanding beyond her years. "I'm glad we don't feel that way anymore." As we walked home that evening, Grace moving confidently without crutches or limping, I realized we had both healed in ways that extended far beyond her physical recovery. We had rebuilt our sense of worth, our understanding of healthy relationships, and our definition of family. The painful incident had forced a reckoning that was long overdue, and through that crucible, we had emerged stronger, not despite the absence of my parents and brother, but because of it. 6 months after Grace's broken leg, our lives had found a new normal. Her physical recovery had progressed remarkably well, as Dr. Layton had predicted. The second, less invasive surgery to remove the hardware had gone smoothly, leaving only a faint scar where the rod and screws had been. She'd returned to soccer, her coach easing her back with modified training sessions before clearing her for full participation. The emotional healing took longer for both of us. Grace still occasionally had nightmares about being left alone while injured. Certain triggers, a particular tone of voice, the smell of pine forests, even the sound of Scrabble tiles clicking together, could momentarily transport her back to that painful weekend. But with therapy and time, these moments grew less frequent and less intense. For me, the journey involved unlearning a lifetime of conditioned responses. I found myself anticipating criticism that no longer came, defending decisions no one was questioning, apologizing for taking up space I had every right to occupy. Breaking these habits required conscious effort and constant self-awareness. My parents hadn't given up entirely. Every few weeks a card would arrive for Grace, always cheerful, always avoiding any mention of what had happened, always signed, "With love from Grandma and Grandpa." I let Grace decide whether to read them. Usually she didn't. "They still don't get it, do they?" she observed one day, holding an unopened birthday card from them. "They think they can just pretend nothing happened." "Some people never develop the capacity to truly acknowledge when they've hurt others," I explained. "It threatens their self-image too much." "That's sad," Grace said, with genuine compassion that amazed me. "It must be lonely, never being able to say you're sorry." Jason had apparently moved on completely. According to my Aunt Eleanor, he'd told extended family that I had mental health issues, and had cut everyone off for no reason. Few believed him, especially after Eleanor quietly shared the actual circumstances. But it didn't matter. Jason's inability to acknowledge his role in harming Grace only confirmed we were better off without him. The most persistent attempts at contact came from my mother. She left messages with mutual friends, sent letters to my school, even approached Grace's soccer coach at a game. Though thankfully, the coach, aware of the situation, politely but firmly refused to get involved. My mother's messages always followed the same pattern. "She missed us, she loved us, she didn't understand why I was being so extreme, and couldn't we just move past this unpleasantness?" Not once did she acknowledge what they had done, or offer a genuine apology. I maintained the boundaries I'd established. The legal letters had done their job. None of them came to our home, or tried to contact Grace directly. But the emotional campaign continued, with my parents positioning themselves as wounded victims to anyone who would listen. Through the Adult Children of Toxic Parent Support Group, I learned this was a common tactic, what some members called the missing reasons. My parents genuinely couldn't comprehend why I had cut contact, because acknowledging the real reason would require them to see themselves as people who had harmed a child. That recognition was simply not compatible with their self-image. Understanding this dynamic didn't make it easier, exactly. But it did help me stop expecting an acknowledgement that would never come. I stopped hoping for the dramatic moment of realization, the tearful apology, the healing reconciliation that movies had taught me to expect. Instead, I focused on building a life where such recognition wasn't necessary for our happiness. Grace and I established new traditions to replace the old ones. Instead of tense holidays at my parents' lake house, we hosted small gatherings with friends in our apartment. For Thanksgiving, we volunteered at a local shelter before enjoying our own meal with Melissa and her family. Christmas became a cozy celebration just for the two of us, with a trip to a nearby resort for skiing, once Grace was fully recovered, of course. My Aunt Eleanor remained our strongest family connection, visiting regularly and sharing stories about my grandparents and great-grandparents that helped me understand the generational patterns at play. Through her, Grace maintained a sense of family history and belonging without the toxic elements my parents had introduced. Perhaps the most surprising development was my relationship with Mark. Our divorce had been amicable but distant, with him pursuing his career across the country while I raised Grace. After the incident with my parents, however, he became more present in our lives, calling Grace regularly, visiting when he could, even helping financially with her medical expenses beyond his required child support. "I should have been there more," he admitted during one visit. "Seeing how your parents failed Grace made me realize I've been failing her too. Just in a different way." His honesty and willingness to change stood in stark contrast to my parents' rigid denial. It wasn't a romantic reconciliation, we were both better as co-parents than spouses. But it was a healing of a different kind of family wound. As for Grace, she amazed me daily with her resilience and wisdom. She approached her recovery with determination, rarely complaining despite the pain and limitations. She processed her feelings about my parents with a maturity beyond her years, expressing sadness without allowing it to define her. "You know what's weird, Mom?" she said one evening as we walked our neighbor's dog, an activity that had become part of her strength-building routine. "I think I learned more from them not being in our lives than I ever did when they were." "What do you mean?" I asked. "I learned what kind of person I don't want to be," she explained. "Someone who can't admit mistakes, someone who cares more about appearances than people's feelings, someone who makes others feel small to make themselves feel big." Her insight took my breath away. "That's a powerful lesson, Grace. Plus," she added with the pragmatism of youth, "I learned that when someone shows you who they are, you should believe them the first time. Maya Angelou said that, right?" I smiled. "She did. And she was—"
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Absolutely right. That, ultimately, was the most profound lesson from our painful experience. My parents and brother had shown me who they were countless times throughout my life. I had made excuses, normalized their behavior, blamed myself, anything to maintain the illusion that they would someday become the loving, supportive family I yearned for. It took their mistreatment of Grace to finally break that pattern and accept the reality. Family is not defined solely by blood. It's defined by love, respect, trust, and mutual care. Sometimes, the healthiest family is the one you choose and build, not the one you're born into. Creating boundaries, even permanent ones, with toxic relatives isn't an act of cruelty, but an act of self-preservation, and in my case, the protection of my child. Grace will carry the physical scar of that weekend for life, a faint line on her leg where the bone was repaired. But the emotional scars have healed better than I could have hoped because we addressed them honestly, sought help when needed, and removed ourselves from the source of harm. As for me, I no longer feel guilty about the estrangement from my parents and brother. I no longer lie awake wondering if I'm the unreasonable one, the overly sensitive one, the dramatic one. I know the truth of what happened, and I know that protecting Grace was the only acceptable response. Some relationships can't be repaired because the other parties refuse to acknowledge the damage. Some broken things are meant to stay broken. The real healing comes not from forcing those broken pieces back together, but from carefully collecting the fragments that still have value and building something new, something healthier, something true. Have you ever had to make a difficult decision to protect yourself or someone you love? How did you find the strength to follow through? I'd love to hear your stories in the comments below. And if you found this story helpful, please like, subscribe, and share with someone who might need to hear that sometimes, walking away is the bravest thing you can do. Thank you for listening, and remember, your worth is not determined by those who failed to value you.